Well, I'm very glad to be with you again here in Crick, or Crich. I was debating in my mind whether you're north or south. I wrote something some time ago, and I spoke about evangelism and the spread of the gospel in the north of England, and I included Birmingham. And someone rapped me over the knuckles for doing that. But it is difficult, isn't it? Because some folk are too far south to be called north, and others are too far north to be called south. So we have some perplexity at times. Well, I'm very glad to be able to speak almost to the day, not quite. Was it 3 weeks ago? Or 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, 300 years ago, this great man, William Grimshaw, was born. That soul shaker, as Ted Hughes, the unbelieving and somewhat hostile poet laureate, as he was, described him. I don't know whether Ted Hughes ever quite got over the soul-shaking preacher Grimshaw. I'm going to quote again from Ted Hughes. Now, most great preachers have also been great characters. And sometimes some of them are remembered much more by their eccentricities than for their spiritual ministry. I suppose Rowland Hill was one such preacher, a great preacher, but very eccentric. I won't tell you what he did on one occasion, otherwise your mind will be taken off what I'm going to say. But and to some extent, this was true with William Grimshaw, though I would dispute anyone who described William Grimshaw as an eccentric. He was a great character, but he really wasn't an eccentric, except perhaps in one or two little matters, which I'll bring out. He was the rugged perpetual curate, as the incumbent of some of these parish churches was called in those days, of Haworth, a town probably known to some of you here this afternoon, situated in the bleak uplands of West Yorkshire, 4 miles from Keighley. I wonder how many of you have been to Haworth. Oh yes, almost all of you. Not quite all of you, but you know who the most frequent overseas visitors are to Haworth? The Japanese. Yes, amazing, isn't it? They're so interested in the Bronte sisters and the literature that has come from them. Well, Mrs. Gaskell, who lived 80 years after Grimshaw died, Mrs. Gaskell, and not Grimshaw, is responsible for the story that Grimshaw horsewhipped the idlers he discovered in the local public houses adjoining the parish church. You've been to Haworth, you know that these public houses are very near to the parish church. Well, Mrs. Grimshaw said that, Mrs. Gaskell said that Grimshaw would go into these pubs, turn out anyone he found in them, and horsewhip them to the parish church during service times in order to preach the gospel to them. Well, you've got to remember Mrs. Gaskell was a novelist. Helps to explain a lot. But that that has some basis in fact, but not as she recounted it. Although, I'll mention that later, although he was a far greater man than Patrick Bronte, the father of the Bronte sisters, who succeeded Grimshaw 80 years after Grimshaw died, and though he did a far greater work, Grimshaw, a far greater work than the Bronte sisters, without depreciating their literary merit, yet the world has largely forgotten Mad Grimshaw, as some of the locals dubbed him, and only remembers with somewhat revolting commercialism the remarkable achievements of those notable literary ladies, the Bronte sisters. But one man who hadn't forgotten Grimshaw and who was brought up in Heptonstall, fairly local to Haworth, Ted Hughes said this: "To judge by the shock waves which could still be felt, I think, into this century, William Grimshaw struck the whole region like a planet," writes the poet in notes to his poetry collection Remains of Elmet, published in 1979. Because to the poet, who was brought up in neighbouring Heptonstall, Grimshaw's influence was still reverberating around the poet's boyhood haunts in the 1930s. Quote, "To a degree," writes Hughes, "Grimshaw changed the very landscape. His heavenly fire, straight out of Blake's prophetic books, shattered the terrain into biblical landmarks. Quarries burst open like craters and chapels, the bedrock transfigured, materialized standing in them. Gradually it dawned on me," he concludes, "that I was living among the survivors in the remains." Now, Ted Hughes didn't believe the gospel, and he wasn't in agreement with the doctrine of William Grimshaw, but you can see that he was very fascinated by the man. How few Christians today know that William Grimshaw was the outstanding pioneer of the evangelical revival in the north of England. Did you know that? Well, you don't have to put your hand up, but if you didn't, it's a good job you're here today, because he was the outstanding pioneer of the evangelical revival in the north of England. Well, we know, of course, that the Wesley brothers had a tremendous impact in Newcastle and the Newcastle area, which they visited frequently throughout their lives. And the significant labours of Benjamin Ingham, who went out to Georgia with the Wesley brothers, and John Nelson in the evangelisation of Yorkshire, must not be overlooked, nor the effect of the occasional visits to the area of George Whitfield and John and Charles Wesley, of course, to the more scattered areas. But William Grimshaw, with his burly frame and powerful voice, did more for the spread of the gospel in the north of England in the 18th century than any other man. He rarely preached. Now, don't take this as a guide to what your pastor ought to be doing, but he rarely preached less than 20 times a week. And sometimes, on some occasions, he preached as many as 30 times. He would go out, you see, from Haworth And probably the first preaching would be 5 o'clock in the morning, and then he would go on somewhere else and people would gather, and he may preach 4 or 5 times in a day. Now, I'm sorry to say to any of you here who are Yorkshire people that Grimshaw was a Lancastrian. And when I mentioned this somewhere or the other in the past, a Lancastrian lady said he was a missionary, really, to get over to them. That was good, wasn't it? Well, he was. He was born in a sleepy little village between Blackburn and Chorley called Brindle on the 14th of September. Have I got that date right? I haven't. Well, he was born 1708, anyway. Oh, yes, it is the right date. 14th of September, 1708. His first recollections of spiritual impressions date from his early childhood, but neither his father, who was a church warden, nor his mother appear to have any vital spiritual life at that time, or subsequently, I'm sorry to say. He was admitted to Christ's College, Cambridge, in April 1726 at the early but not unusual age of 17. You see, whereas we have our sixth forms, and they go from the sixth form to university, they would go in those days much earlier. They weren't necessarily more clever, you see. It was just the system was different. Well, for the first 2 years, Grimshaw tells us that he was sober and diligent, but in the third year, to quote his own words, he says, "Falling in with bad company, I learned to drink, swear, and what not." Now, this was no obstacle to ordination, either then or now, I'm sorry to say. In 1731, he became curate in charge of Littleborough, near Rochdale, where his heavy drinking and worldly way of life continued. After 6 months, we're not sure why he changed so quickly, after 6 months midway between, he moved to Todmorden, midway between Bacup and Hebden Bridge, where he became curate in charge in Todmorden. A contemporary historian tells us that the inhabitants at that time in that area between Todmorden and Halifax were, quote, "wild, uncouth, and rugged as their native hills." You know, Christians today tend to think that things in our society are bad, very bad. Well, they are, but they're not as bad as they were. Not at all. Far from it. We're moving in that direction, but they were very bad in those days. No traveller could pass that way in assured safety. And Daniel Defoe tells us that the barbarity of the behaviour was matched by a barbarity of punishment. Such local barbarity gave rise in Defoe's opinion to the proverbial saying, "From hell, Hull, and Halifax, good Lord deliver us." I don't know why Hull should be included. I would include it now, these days, but in those days I don't know why it was included. And Defoe couldn't determine either. Well, a 23-year-old Grimshaw was little better than the average inhabitant of the area at that time. His main interests were fishing, card playing, and hunting, and his pastoral visits were usually occasions for heavy drinking and merrymaking, but all this was soon to change. During this time, Grimshaw was not without pangs of conscience and longings to be a better man. He had suffered periods of remorse and self-reproach, and he'd fought against temptation and sin, but he found it to be a losing battle. He had sought to improve by adopting higher moral standards and urging them upon the people within his parish. But failing to preach the gospel, he had to resort to some bizarre methods. An example of this occurred when a young man in the parish made a girl pregnant, but refused to do what was then regarded as the honourable thing by marrying her. Instead, he was flippant and arrogant in his attitude, so Grimshaw determined to teach him a lesson. And this is where perhaps you might think Grimshaw was a little bit eccentric, because he did what he often, well, what he did on occasions, he dressed up. He loved dressing up, did Grimshaw, and he dressed up as the devil. He put dark clothing on. You know, people think of the devil as a sort of creature with horns and a tail, and so Grimshaw dressed up to resemble what people thought the devil looked like. And then, having dressed up, he concealed himself near a stile over which this young man, at dusk, when the light was going, that's when they usually finished work in the past, would come over the stile on his way home. And so Grimshaw waited in the shadows, and as this young man came over the stile, he rose up with a terrifying appearance, and he grasped the young man with an iron grip, and he threatened to take him back to Hades if he didn't marry the girl and do the right thing. And the man was scared out of his wits, and he promised to put the matter right. Well, one day, in 1734, Grimshaw was asked to help a young married couple whose baby had died suddenly. Today they would have called it a cot death. And this was Grimshaw's advice, quote, "to put away all gloomy thoughts and to get into merry company and divert themselves, and all would be right." Sounds like a bit of modern psychotherapy, doesn't it? Well, it didn't work, and again he was sent for. And he had to confess to the parents that he was helpless to advise them, because he was as in desperate a condition spiritually as they were. That was honest, wasn't it? And this experience of his own inadequacy spiritually shook him so much that from this time onwards a new seriousness entered his life, and he began to seek the Lord. Now, this period of conviction he was later to describe in the following words. This is taken from an unpublished manuscript. Quote, He has looked into the bottomless pit, he's describing himself, has seen his own offences tormented in others and their brands shaken at him. He has seen the devil's face both as a tempter and a tormentor. He has heard the clamour of conscience and been therewith so disquieted as not to rest till he betake himself to God, with whom he at first meets with rigour, but soon after with mercy and compassion. But at this time, before that happened, he had not yet obtained mercy, and his awakening was mainly moral, you see, mainly moral in character. And he began to warn his parishioners of their spiritual danger, and he himself became diligent in his own duties as the curate in charge of this Todmorden church. But his only message to the people was to urge upon the people a strict and upright life. "My friends," he cried out in despair in the middle of a service. This is where his honesty comes out. "We are in a damnable state, and I scarcely know how we are to get out of it." Well, the time of his release had not yet arrived. But what did arrive, and this diverted him from his spiritual concerns, was a dashing young widow, Sarah Sutcliffe by name, who had him clearly in her sights. And with breathtaking initiative and audacity, she rode on a horse, of course, past his lodgings, calling out to him, "I am come to bid a penny at you," which was in those days a way of proposing marriage. He did know her. Well, like many another unsuspecting young man in similar circumstances, he fell for her and married this well-to-do heiress soon afterwards. Well, a son, John, was born 10 months later in April 1736, and then in the following year, a daughter, Jane. Throughout this period, the outward forms of moral and religious reformation had been maintained, but his inner spiritual interest had subsided. His wife was of little help to him spiritually. He loved her deeply, but she was of no help to him. God had not let him go, though. He experienced another spiritual quickening in 1738, when he began to apply himself with much diligence and regular prayer to self-examination and religious duties. What he did was to buy a large folio volume, and he kept a diary. And on one side he entered his sins, on the other side he entered his good works, and he hoped each day that the good works would balance out the sins. Well, what a hopeless state. And it reminds you, doesn't it, of the early members of the Holy Club, as they were called, those godly students who met together in Oxford, seeking the Lord in the same way. The Wesleys, George Whitfield, Benjamin Ingham and William Morgan and others, who sought to secure their salvation by their own righteousness. And Grimshaw, with frequent fasting, was engaged in the same fruitless pursuit. He knew that he was not right with God, but though there had been a reformation of life and a new seriousness had entered into his pastoral work, yet he was still in bondage of soul, not knowing anything of real peace with God or of God's forgiveness. He was seven years like this. Well, then, in November 1739, Grimshaw's wife died, leaving him with two small children and in desolation of spirit. His wife's family took the two children, and he was left alone, close to despair. He experienced, consequently, a terrible time of fierce temptation and spiritual conflict, when every holy thing seemed to be threatened by blasphemous thoughts and fearful doubts. Satan was sifting him, but God was bringing him to the end of himself. A travelling preacher had frequently, we don't know who he was, it may have been William Darnie, who I may mention later, a travelling preacher had frequently rebuked Grimshaw for his legalistic view of salvation. "Mr. Grimshaw, you are a Jew. You are no believer in Jesus Christ. You are building on the sand." And those true words kept echoing in his mind, "You are building on the sand." Then one day, early in 1742, he was in the house of a friend, and there he picked up a book, and instantly a strange flash of heat fell upon him. He looked at the book, he picked it up, he opened the title, he opened the book and looked at the title page, and another strange flash of heat came upon him. He discovered the book to be by Dr. John Owen on justification by faith. And in whatever way you may attempt to explain this strange phenomena of these flashes of heat, Grimshaw himself believed it was a heaven-sent sign. And I hold Grimshaw's view of that phenomenon. The title page of Owen's book read, quote, "The doctrine of justification by faith through the imputed righteousness of Christ, explained, confirmed, and vindicated," and I think we should add, "as only John Owen could do it." Within the book, Owen outlined his purpose, to inquire diligently into the divine revelation of the way whereby the conscience of a distressed sinner may attain assured peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Here at last was help for the poor, tormented soul of William Grimshaw. He borrowed the book, he read it carefully, and he described the result as follows. "I was now willing to renounce myself, every degree of fancied merit and ability, and to embrace Christ only for my all in all. Oh, what light and comfort did I now enjoy in my own soul, and what a taste of the pardoning love of God. His 7 years of seeking and searching were at an end." Well, the joys of salvation were reflected immediately in Grimshaw's preaching. His emphasis now came strongly upon salvation by faith alone, through the imputed righteousness of Christ, and no longer upon the works of man's righteousness. Some accused him of preaching a strange and novel doctrine, but he demonstrated from the 39 articles of the Church of England that this was not so. Some success followed his preaching at Todmorden, and this was later to become one of the early Methodist strongholds, Todmorden. But Grimshaw had married again about 6 months before his conversion, and he and his wife were soon to move to Haworth. His wife, his second wife, was no help to him at all. Well, in Haworth he became what was called the perpetual curate in charge. His new wife, Elizabeth, brought up his two children by his former wife, but sadly, after 5 years, she fell sick with a fever and died. And do you know what he did? He got one of these Portuguese golden coins, I've just forgotten the name of them, and he cast lots. He tossed the coin and he called out, I don't know whether it was heads or tails, but he called out one or the other, and he said that if it fell one way, he would marry and seek a wife again. If it fell the other way, he would take it as an indication from the Lord that he was not to seek a wife. Well, it fell negatively. So for the rest of his life, he was unmarried, which I think was a mistake on his part. I'm not pronouncing upon this use of lots, because it was used, wasn't it, in the New Testament, when all human thinking and investigation had taken place. Well, the early church, the apostles, if you remember, they cast lots. I'm not going to open a debate. You can ask a question if you like. But anyway, that's what happened to Grimshaw. It's what he did. And from 1744 onwards, and throughout the 21 years of his ministry in Grimshaw, he became the acknowledged leader of the evangelical revival in the north of England. Great blessing came upon his ministry. Soon after he settled in 1742 in Howarth, there began this remarkable revival of religion in Howarth and in the area. And then it grew, and for the rest of his ministry, there was a tremendous spread of the gospel throughout the north of England. And it was without question one of the great consequences of the evangelical revival. But God had his man where he wanted him. From the mid-1730s onwards, revival had been breaking out spontaneously in different parts of Europe and America, in London and Bristol. People had been aroused by the preaching of George Whitfield and John Wesley. Howell Harris had established numerous preaching centres in Wales, and he was soon joined in the work by Daniel Rowlands. And spiritual awakening had affected the highlands of Scotland in 1739, and in 1742 a mighty work of God took place in Cambuslang and Kilsyth. The north of England felt the first effects of the revival in 1738, when Benjamin Ingham, returning from Georgia, he was born at Osset in Yorkshire, and he was a former member of the Holy Club in Oxford. He returned to his home area, and he began to have a significant effect through his itinerant preaching. This is Benjamin Ingham in the areas of Wakefield, Osset, Leeds and Halifax. And then, of course, we have to mention another great man, John Nelson, who was converted under John Wesley in London. But he was a native of Birstall in the West Riding of Yorkshire, and he soon joined Benjamin Ingham in this work. And these two men, Ingham and Nelson, were instrumental in establishing over 50 religious societies in the West Riding of Yorkshire and in Lancashire. And Grimshaw, in his account of the revival he wrote in 1754, he speaks of a great ingathering of souls through the work of those two men, Ingham and Nelson. But in 1742, when the revival first started to break out in Howarth, Grimshaw was only vaguely aware of what was going on, except he was able to write, in this year our dear Lord was pleased to visit my parish. We see, therefore, that the revival in Howarth in 1742 was a local manifestation of a far greater work of God. But the repercussions of the Howarth revival were to extend eventually in all the adjoining counties. The revival in Howarth broke out almost as soon as Grimshaw began to preach there. The town at that time was one of the most important centres for the Worcester clothing industry, with much of the work being done in local homes. You know, places that we consider unimportant today were in the past very important because of the canal system and that sort of thing. No good roads. So Howarth was very important in those days for the Worcester clothing industry. People in the town were tough, of an independent character, and with few human graces, and the rugged, straight speaking, no nonsense Grimshaw appealed to these people. His dedication and burning zeal for their eternal interests soon deeply affected them, because they felt his love for them. And the handful of worshippers on his arrival at Haworth quickly became an overflowing congregation. Grimshaw describes the beginning of the revival as follows. In 1742, our dear Lord was pleased to visit my parish. A few souls were affected under the word, brought to see their lost estate by nature, and to experience peace through faith in the blood of Jesus. My church began to be crowded insomuch that many were obliged to stand out of doors. Here, as in other places, it was amazing to hear and see what weeping, roaring, and agonies many people were seized with at the apprehension of their spiritual state and the wrath of God. The church building held about 1,000 hearers, but soon many could only find room in the churchyard, which is very extensive, as those of you who have been to Haworth will know. People flocked from other parishes to listen to the preacher who told them how their sins could be forgiven. Grimshaw frequently preached to overflowing crowds of men and women standing patiently in the churchyard, often in biting winds which swept down from the Pennines. When Whitfield and the Wesleys later preached there, the extensive graveyard would be thronged with people numbering upwards of 6,000. And I must tell you, because I've been invited to sort of break halfway through, so I'm taking a little bit extra time. I must tell you something I might have omitted otherwise. On one occasion, this is very interesting, on one occasion, the 8th of August 1756, Whitfield announced, this was to all the people in the churchyard, they had built up a sort of scaffold, and Whitfield and Grimshaw came out of a window from the church and addressed the people in the church burial ground. Whitfield announced his text, "It is appointed unto men once to die." And at that, there was a terrifying, wild shriek from someone in the crowd. And Grimshaw hurried to the spot, and he returned and called out to Whitfield, "Brother Whitfield, you stand amongst the dead and the dying. An immortal soul has been called into eternity. The destroying angel is passing over the congregation. Cry aloud and spare not." And so after a little while, Whitfield again announced his text, "It is appointed unto men once to die, and after this the judgment." And again, a loud and piercing cry came from the spot just nearby to where Lady Huntingdon was standing with her sister-in-law, Lady Margaret Ingham. And a thrill of horror spread through the crowd when they learnt that a second person had fallen victim to the King of Terrors. You can imagine what tension there was when, for a third time, Whitfield indicated that he would proceed, and amidst the hush again announced his text, "It is appointed unto men once to die. But after this, the judgment." And then preached with tremendous eloquence, warning sinners to flee from the wrath to come. Well, the physical manifestations associated with the revival, Grimshaw tended to discourage, rightly I think. The roarings, the convulsions that took place, and the agonies easily became a part of the devil's work. And that can easily discredit the gospel. What Grimshaw sought was conviction of sin, true conviction of sin, and the power of Jesus Christ in a conversion from a love of sin to a love of righteousness. He believed strongly in the duty of reproving and rebuking sin, and believed that all Christians have a responsibility to admonish sin and sinners. He wrote a manuscript which has never been published, entitled The Admonition of the Sinner. And in this manuscript we read that on one occasion he was in a local shop, and a man came in who was well known in the area for his serial adulteries. And Grimshaw immediately announced to all in the shop, "The devil has been very busy in this neighbourhood. I can touch the man with my stick who lay with another man's wife last night. The end of these things will be death, the ruin of body and soul forever." You can imagine the traumatic effect that that had upon the people gathered in the shop. Well, in the summer of 1743, Grimshaw began to organise his converts into little groups, and he visited and exhorted them in their cottage meetings throughout the parish and in the surrounding parishes. At first he was reluctant to cross parish boundaries. John Newton has got it wrong. He wrote a little sort of biography of Grimshaw, which was strangely inaccurate. And about the spiritual needs of the people of the area, neglected by the other clergymen in the area, persuaded Grimshaw to do it, that is, to cross parish boundaries, which Church of England ministers are not supposed to do without the permission of the various incumbents. An insight into the great work that went on in Howarth at this time is found in a letter written by a Mr. Joseph Williams, a clothier of Kidderminster, who made frequent visits to Howarth in connection with his business, and he writes of a visit he made in 1746. He says this: "The work of conversion still goes on under his," that's Grimshaw's, "ministry, and many are now under deep conviction and are frequently coming to him for direction and comfort. One young man came while I was there, who together with his newly married wife are under such vast concern for their souls, they scarcely know how to apply themselves to their outward calling till they have secured their immortal interest." Sometimes Grimshaw would preach as long as 2 hours, but with great power and tremendous eloquence. Although on one occasion he was approached by someone who suggested he preached a little shorter because John Wesley did. "Oh," said Grimshaw, "oh, what a dear man Wesley is. He can do in 1 hour what it takes me 2 hours to do." And with that he carried on in his style. Well, another visitor describes how after hearing Grimshaw preach, she dined in the local inn crowded with about 100 strangers, yet all the talk that's in this inn was, quote, "such as would good to the use of edify." The daily lives of the people were soon affected by the revival. Immorality and foul language declined. The drinking houses lost quite a number of their customers. Not that Grimshaw was a teetotaler. Well, people weren't teetotalers in those days, you understand. It was about the only safe drink you could have, ale, because of water. And the great emphasis was on sobriety, which of course is the emphasis of Scripture. But it was the other problems, drunkenness, that Grimshaw preached against. The Sunday sports were abandoned, Mrs. Gaskell, as I have said, is responsible for the story that Grimshaw used a horsewhip to get the drinkers in local pubs into the church. There was the law of the land said that everybody had to go to church on a Sunday. Yeah. And therefore, they hadn't any business to be in the local pub, according to the law of the land. And the publicans had no business to serve beer or anything in the pubs during service times. Well, Mrs. Gaskell is responsible for this story that he used to horsewhip the drinkers in the local pubs, driving them into the church. Well, she wrote 90 years after Grimshaw's death. And the story arose, I think, from her vivid imagination. As I said earlier, after all, she was a novelist. But like most embroidered stories, there was some basis of fact. It was true that Grimshaw's custom, before he preached, and in the psalm that was sung just before he came to preach, it was true that either he went out to check the churchyard and the nearby public houses for any idlers who ought to have been in church, and sometimes when he found them, well, they were firmly directed into the church with that authority common in those days to the parson. Two colourful incidents were the likely material for Mrs. Gaskell's story. The first is of an occasion when Grimshaw sent out two church wardens to check up on any parishioners idling their time away in the public houses nearby, instead of attending worship. The time went by, the psalm had finished, and the church wardens had not reappeared. So Grimshaw himself went out in search of the wardens whilst the congregation waited. And after a while, the congregation heard heavy footsteps approaching. The porch door was suddenly flung open, and the stentorian tones of Grimshaw's voice were heard. "What think you? What think you?" he boomed. "The church wardens who went out to detect others and prevent them from sinning, I have found in the inn drinking a pint of ale. For shame, for shame, for shame," he cried, as he mounted the steps to his pulpit, and the church wardens sneaked in at the back of the congregation and took their seats. Well, that's one true story. And the second incident, which did most, I think, to give rise to Mrs. Gaskell's story of the horsewhip, since it includes the use of a horsewhip, you've got to remember they were very different days to ours, was in far different circumstances. The people who were spiritually minded in the church, they used to meet regularly for a prayer meeting in a certain place, and a group of unruly youths had taken delight in jostling and assaulting some of the villagers as they gathered for this weekly prayer meeting. Of course, there was no lighting in those days. Things were so different. And one needs to remember there were no policemen either. Sometimes there were local men appointed to sort of uphold the law to some degree. Well, after this had happened two or three times, these people come into the prayer meeting being jostled, the leader of the meeting reported it to Grimshaw. And Grimshaw asked to be informed if it happened again, and it did happen again. Once more, the same hooligans sat upon the people as they gathered. So, on the next occasion, Grimshaw dressed up, he liked dressing up, disguised in a great coat, joined the youths pretending to be one of them. And being dark, of course, pitch black often, they did not recognise the burly figure of the curate, who from the back of their group was urging them on into the cottage where the prayer meeting was being held. Gradually, he inched the gang down the narrow passageway nearer and nearer to the lighted doorway of the cottage where the meeting was to be held. And then with one mighty heave, he managed to get all the youths into the room of the cottage and then slammed the door. And still blinking in the light, the youths scarcely realised what was happening until they discovered their new companion suddenly produced a horsewhip from under his great coat and, we are told, dealt round its utmost virtue on the astonished clowns until his vigorous arm was tired. Having suitably chastened them, Grimshaw then fell on his knees and pleaded with great earnestness for their souls. Well, you may think it strange that those two incidents come together, but you've got to realise the days and the era in which that occurred. Many amazing conversions took place during the revival. One woman recounted how she and her husband, who were former Quakers, living 6 miles from Haworth, how they were brought into salvation. Her husband went to Haworth on one occasion out of curiosity to hear this preacher, and he was converted. And he then, of course, tried to persuade his wife to go with him to hear Grimshaw. "I'll not go to hear that black devil," she retorted. Well, constant pleas from her husband failed to move her. So one day, her husband forcibly dressed her in her Sunday best, took a rod, and drove her the 6 miles to Haworth. She said, "As men drive a beast to market, I went calling and abusing Mr. Grimshaw all the way." You can see what sort of people they were in those days in that area. Well, she was brought under conviction, and the following Sunday returned to Haworth of her own accord. And Grimshaw noticed her distress under his preaching, and after the service he sought her out and told her that on a certain day he would come and preach in their home. And that farmhouse, the man was a farmer, that farmhouse became one of his regular preaching centres. And she was one of the first of a great number who were converted there under Grimshaw's preaching. Now, I think that's a good point at which to have a break. So,